Hi everyone, it's Kim. Now, a couple of weeks ago, The Comb was in sunny Kenya, and it was great to be able to finally be out and about meeting some of you. Now, as part of that trip, we recorded several stories. We kicked off last week with an episode about two Kenyan women who've been on a journey to own and control their sexual identities. If you haven't listened to that episode, you really should go back and check it out. There are other really interesting stories lined up that, although they were recorded in Kenya, I know many of you will be able to relate to them. On today's episode, what happens when you're forced to reimagine what fatherhood looks like?
He never said mama, dad. So that's the first red flag, because you're like, you'd expect that to be his first word. He didn't have any words. And then,
like, he used to line up his toys in a certain way. And guests will come like, don't, please, do not touch.
And if somebody touched them, what would happen?
Meltdown. Serious meltdown.
But you can like wave to a child and they wave back, or smile and they smile back, or like go to shake his hand and they reach out to you and like grab you. When he wasn't having any of those reactions, then we said maybe something might be off.
We had no clue what was going on. Fathers, African fathers, don't talk about it.
How two fathers are navigating the maze of barriers that come with raising a child with special needs. I'm Kim Chakaneta, and this is The Comb, a BBC World Service original podcast.
This is The Comb.
Ye ni The Comb.
The Comb, no.
Ni The Comb.
The Comb.
Hi, Steve. A couple of weeks ago, I caught a taxi and headed across the city to the west side of Nairobi.
Approaching Bunyala roundabout.
To meet Duncan.
Hi.
Hello.
Come in.
Hi.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm good.
Duncan, hi. Sorry, I should say hello. Hi, sorry.
I'll
just do it this way. Elbows.
That's Faith, my
That's
wife.
That's Faith. Nice to meet you, Faith.
No, you are Baba. Take the phone from Baba. No.
Duncan is a father of four. And on the sunny, cloudless Saturday afternoon, he was in full dad mode.
Luca. Luca. No,
Baba. Hi.
Hi.
I can touch them.
That's a microphone, Luca.
Yeah, that's a microphone. That's Luca, you can hear, getting to know my microphone. Luca is five and a mini copy of his father. He's smart and athletic and a big fan of the cartoon Cocomelon.
Cocomelon!
Apart from a few words, Luca doesn't talk. He has a condition called nonverbal autism. So in order to communicate, Luca has a range of cues. For example, he'll point to the TV mounted on the wall and Duncan will know which cartoon Luca wants on. And today, it's the cheerful chaos of the Cocomelon universe. For Duncan, this is more or less a typical Saturday, running various family errands, cheering on Liverpool. He's a diehard fan. He once asked his wife that should he die, could she spread his ashes at the Liverpool grounds Anfield? She gave him a firm hell no. Duncan will also hang out with friends and see his wider family. But all of these activities need to be fitted in around the thing at the centre of his life. Being a father.
Yeah.
So Duncan, when you thought of fatherhood,
yeah,
how did you imagine it would be? This is before you had any kids.
I wanted to be the best father that I could be. I looked at my dad, my foster dad, and to me he was the best father. My dad, who basically raised me, I call him my dad, was my mom's brother.
Okay.
He was a senior government official.
Okay.
So, and my biological dad, well, he was not in my life for quite some time. Got to know him later on.
And what do you think constituted a good father?
Being there, being loving, being firm, loving but firm.
Yeah.
Encouraging my kids, seeing my kids thrive and achieving.
Over the past few years, Duncan's relationship to the world has shifted. And that started with the birth of Luca. Up until they arrived at the hospital, things had been going smoothly. But once there, the doctor struggled to find a heartbeat.
And I can see the panic in his face. He's trying to listen to the heartbeat. And he's asking the nurse, "Have you been hearing the heartbeat?" He's like, "I can't hear the heartbeat." So he's like, "We need to get her to theater now."
It was a close call. Luca's umbilical cord had been wrapped around his neck. But luckily, everyone was safe and well. Duncan says when he met Luca, he was smitten.
So he was so cute, and I took a photo, and I'm like, wow. And I'm like, oh, being a dad, all that. Oh, Luca was a joy. Luca was that kid who was, he never used to sleep. Oh my God.
Not at all.
Oh.
How many times would you be waking up at night?
Over 5 times. I was a zombie. And that happened like first year, second year. And we just like, why does this kid not sleep?
Yeah.
Like, what's wrong with this kid? Like, we go for bath.
Now, sleepless nights are not unusual for new parents. But in Luca's case, the problem seemed different.
He's not sleeping, he's hyper.
Okay.
He's very particular in terms of if he puts this glass here in this angle and you move it 1 degree, he'll notice. Like, he used to line up his toys in a certain way. And like, guests will come and be like, "Don't, please, do not touch."
Yeah. And if somebody touched them, what would happen?
Meltdown. Serious meltdown.
And how long were the meltdowns last?
2-3 hours. We had no clue what was going on.
It was an encounter at a birthday party that would eventually lead Duncan and his wife to an understanding of what was behind Luca's unusual behaviour.
Went for a birthday party, and there was a lady seated next to us, and she's a teacher at an international school. And then she asked us, "Is that your son?" We're like, "Yeah." Like, "Do you know he's special? Do you know he's a genius?" We're like, "How can you tell? He's just like 3 years old." Like, "No, I teach his age group. I can tell he's special." So we're like, "What do you mean?" So she's like, "Quick example, where are all the other kids? Bouncing castle, face painting." Like, "Where's your son?" "You know, the opposite side." "What is he doing?" "He's fascinated with, he's holding 2 forks and he's fascinated at how the forks are intertwining. And he's picking stones and feeling the edges of the stone. Like, he's trying to understand how everything works."
So on one level, Luca was appreciating things on a different level to his peers. But he was also struggling with other things.
A few days later, we went for his diagnosis. And I remember the doctor, Dr. Aliyah. And we did all the tests and she told us, "Okay, look, I'm sorry to tell you guys, but yeah, you, Luca is autistic."
Autism Spectrum Disorder, or ASD, refers to a group of neurodevelopment disorders that affect how people communicate, learn, behave, and socially interact. The abilities of people with ASD can vary significantly. Some people may have advanced conversation skills, whereas others, for example Luca, may be nonverbal. There are other symptoms too, which vary from person to person, from delayed childhood development, scrambled sensory processing, to tendencies towards repetitive behaviour. Everyone with ASD experiences it differently. Duncan remembers with clarity the moment the doctor gave them the diagnosis.
And we're like, "Oh, okay." It's like, "Do you guys need a moment?" We're like, "No." Like, "Wait, hold up. I have done this my whole career." Parents always break down. "You're the first couple I've told, and you're smiling."
And you're smiling because?
Now we get it. Now we understand. Of course, now the severity when we got home, and I'm like, "Babe, I don't even know what autism is. We had no information. Mm-hmm. But with time when he started, we're like, started learning about autism. Like, Luca can basically have his life, live his life to the fullest.
In the years since they got that diagnosis, Duncan has been reckoning with what it means to have a son with autism in a world where people often have little to no understanding of the condition. The fact that Luca might not play like other kids, or that he doesn't communicate a certain way and that he can get upset over certain things, means that he's often left out of neighborhood parties and events. And then there are relatives who have their own take on Luca's condition.
I have had a relative telling me I was cursed. That hurt me.
Of course.
I told them I'll never talk to them again. So I cancelled them out of my life.
And Duncan has faced another more profound struggle with his Anglican faith.
So diagnosis comes, Luca is autistic. I'm like, okay, we'll handle this. I got this. I'm praying to God for a miracle that this thing will disappear. So I'm praying and I'm like, God, please heal my child. Please heal my child. I'll do anything. Just heal my child. We try with my wife to go. We're like, okay, we need to be going to church. So we go to church fast. And since we can't really leave him, we have to go with him to the main service. And in the main service, he's flapping, he's, you know, and everyone is looking, so we have to walk out. And everyone's just like, just staring at us. And so I tell my wife, we need to leave, because I don't like the stairs. I'm feeling uncomfortable. So we leave. We try to do the creche where they have the smaller kids. And he's all over the class running around. And they're like, oh, your child is so disruptive.
Further compounding Duncan's shaken faith was the birth of his youngest child.
And then my wife gets pregnant, gives birth to Khalai, my daughter. And she has albinism. And I'm like, what the? I'm like, seriously, I love my daughter. But I'm like, God, why? Like, I'm like, autism, I've accepted. Albinism again. And I've never reconciled. I'm angry.
You're angry?
Very. So I've reached a point, sadly, that I think I'm agnostic. I've lost my faith.
Away from Duncan's private battles with his beliefs, there have been more public battles. Like when Duncan and his wife, Faith, finally found Luca a place at a local school, which had assured them that they would be able to accommodate him. But just 2 days later, they called and suggested that he look for another school. On top of that, the school insisted that it didn't have a refund policy, despite Luca only attending for 2 days. Duncan wasn't having any of that. Earlier in our interview, Duncan had said to me,
I raise hell when it comes to my kids.
And that's exactly what he did. He lined up a lawyer, tweeted about it, told people he knew about it, and soon it was picked up by the local press and was all over social media.
He's only 4 years old. He's facing a bit of challenges in school, but he's not the only one. So since the resumption of schools earlier in the year, parents with special needs children...
The upshot of this drama was that the school eventually refunded the family their money, but it also helped Duncan come to a realization. People had begun reaching out to him about similar situations they had been in, and they wanted his help.
Most of the people who were contacting me were women, mothers. I'm like, where are the dads? Where are the dads?
To try to answer that question, Duncan would eventually start the Nairobi chapter of an organization known as the Special Fathers Network.
It's a mentor program for fathers who are raising kids with special needs. It's not autism, it's just anything. So I tweeted about it and told guys, I'm trying to set up, blah, blah, blah. And I got over 300 requests. So right now I have a network of around 20 fathers.
20 fathers.
Currently, the group meets via Zoom, and Duncan regularly fields calls and meets fathers wanting to talk. His goal is simple.
I want a safe space for fathers, and I keep telling, just a safe space for fathers to come and just talk about their fears, talk about their vulnerabilities, have a safe space.
Having heard about the Special Fathers Network and the way it's become such an important form of support for these fathers, I really wanted to meet somebody else who's part of it. And Duncan suggested I speak to Richard. So I'm on my way to meet Richard, and Richard actually initially got in touch with Duncan via Twitter, and then he joined the Special Fathers Network. So I'd like to hear about his experiences, so I'm heading over to his house now. It was a Saturday, so there were some kids joyfully playing at full volume in the yard below. There's also, less joyfully, some building work going on across the road, which you might hear from time to time. I met Richard at a flat he shares with his wife, Rosette, and his two sons, Luke, who is 6, and Arthur, who's 3.
Arthur was up by 6, but we got him to go back to sleep.
Richard is a 37-year-old physicist.
It's not common for guys who study physics to actually practice physics, because the jobs aren't that many. So for me, I get to work in the lab every day.
He's also a hands-on father, soothing, carrying, playing with his boys. But up until fatherhood happened, fatherhood had not been on his agenda.
We were not trying.
Okay.
So it just happened. And then the fun thing is, I was going for some work in Mozambique. So she actually sent me the message when I was like literally about to board the plane. I think I need to go get a test. So that 4-6 hour flight, I just spent thinking, I don't think I'm ready to be a dad.
So how long had you been together at that point, you and Rosette?
About 6 months.
Ah, I see. Okay.
Richard was away for 2 weeks, and he spent that time doing some serious soul searching.
The whole time I went back and forth, but I'm like, I'm not ready. Do I want to do this? I remember sitting in that hotel room in Mozambique, and I was thinking, if I'm going to be a dad, I have to decide to be a dad. It's not something that I have to ease my way into this. Yes, I'm going to learn on the job, but I have to make a conscious decision to make the effort to be a dad. So while I was alone, I thought about it and decided, you know what? If this is what God wants for me right now, I have to accept it. And then once I decided I'm going to be a dad, I came back with a plan. I had a plan for how we're going to give birth, what's going to be the maternity plan, how we're going to live. And that's when I started making plans, I started reading up, I started looking up all the information.
Was there anything that scared you about becoming a parent?
Yes. Considering how much therapy I've had to go through myself, just, I didn't want to traumatize my kids.
Yeah.
You never know what you could do, but I'm like, at least I'll put in the effort to try not to. Because my big thing is, I hope my kids are good people. So I can't tell them to be good people if I'm not a good person. So for me, that's the big thing. I'm like, I don't want them to look at me and say, he used to say one thing, but then do something different.
Yeah.
So that's the thing that always scared me the most, because kids remember.
The loss of his father at a young age also factored in when it came to what sort of father he wanted to be.
Because when my dad died young, for me, that's the one thing that I always said, I could be any kind of father. As long as I'm there, it would, I hope, would be better than having none at all.
Like many first-time parents, Richard and Rosette wanted to be prepared.
We read everything. We read all the newsletters, all the booklets, all the... That's when we discovered parenting YouTube. Because when they say there's a community for everything on YouTube, we prepared in advance for like up to like 3 or 4, just continuously watching all sorts of... Just vociferously trying to consume as much information as we could, because we didn't know. I'm a big fan of classical music, so we used to play a lot of classical music next to the belly at night. We used to talk to him, we used to play him. There were even some, I don't know whether it's just any sounds that used to make him kick, but towards the end of the pregnancy, there was a particular song by an artist called Trip Lee that every time we used to play it, he always used to kick. So like, this is his song.
This is jam.
Yeah, that was his jam.
After a smooth and complicated birth, Richard's first son, Luke, was born.
And what was it like meeting him for the first time?
It was very emotional. I remember I burst into tears and the doctor was like, why are you crying? You're not the one who was pushed. Because you're like, you know, with all that information you're consuming, you also want to prepare yourself. What could go wrong? Mm-hmm. You're like, until you have your child in your arms, like crying, you're never truly out of the woods. That's what everybody always used to say. So for me, just holding him and hearing him cry, and just the relief, like, wow, we actually got through this. So it was really emotional.
So when then did you first notice that Luke's development was further behind?
I'd say at about 2 years, because his physical development was going well, he was hitting all his milestones. But then at the point where you'd be expecting him to do gestures and maybe he responds, I tries to mimic the gestures, he wasn't like mimicking gestures. It's like, maybe it's taking a bit of time. And then when you start to expect him, because that's at around 2 is when you expect him to start saying his first words, mama, dada. So he never said mama, dada. So that's the first red flag, because you're like, you'd expect that to be his first word. Especially the mimicking of gestures, that's the one that was really, because they might not speak, but you can like wave to a child and they wave back, or smile and they smile back, or like go to shake his hand and he'll reach out to you and like grab you. At that point when he wasn't having any of those reactions, then we said maybe something might be off.
Similar to Luca, Duncan's son, Luke has nonverbal autism. And while getting that diagnosis was a source of relief for Richard, it also meant readjusting to the reality of Luke's condition.
I think that kills you, the hope. You keep hoping that, oh, maybe he might start to speak, or he might, it's just a delay. But then at least now we know what the issue is. We know that then there are other things which we can look forward to rather than just waiting to hear his first word. Because it was very discouraging for me, because we have friends who had kids like around the same time as us. You go, you visit them, and the kids are saying, daddy, carry me. And you're like, my son has never like shown any interest in me at all. Like, it used to be really hard, because like when you leave, and I'd leave in the morning, like say, bye Luke, and he just look at you and then continue without you. It was no difference me being there, me not being there. If his mom was like going somewhere, like he would not react at all. Like how kids would like be really torn up when like a parent is leaving the room.
Yeah.
At that time, he had no such response. So we're like, okay, fine. We know that his brain is wired slightly different. So we know how to respond to him based on where he is right now.
Richard says the initial reactions they received from some family members about Luke's autism made them reluctant to share news of the diagnosis.
Like when I told my mom, her first reaction was, there's nothing wrong with him, he's just shy. So you're like, you know, we've given him some time. He's not shy. It's a neurological condition. It's like, no. He's just shy. Just give him some time. He doesn't need any therapy. My mother-in-law had said, bring him to us. Give us 2 weeks with him and we'll send him back to you talking. For us, our biggest concern is what happens to our kids if something happened to us and we went around. Because we think about our mortality more than like most people would need to, because what happens to Luke when we're not here? Who takes the time? Who takes as much time as we have to like learn his habits, to spend like all their time with him, to be gentle with him as they learn his habits, to not get overly frustrated? Because yes, he's an autistic child, but he's also just a regular, like very cheeky boy.
First hear about the Special Fathers Network?
I first heard about it last year when Duncan was asking on Twitter whether there would be any interest in forming such a group. I remember I responded immediately and said, if there's a group, if there's any such network, I'd want to be part of it.
And how do you feel it's helped you?
For me, it's two things. It's one, having just a pool of resources from other people who are going through the same thing. Just guys with similar experiences who can tell us about things they've tried that have worked, things that have tried that have not worked, specialists they've talked to, doctors they've talked to, therapists they've talked to, schools that they're taking their children to, restaurants that they go to that are accommodating, hotels that they go to on vacation. Just having this, that large pool of information, people who are going through the same thing, who can share.
It's the space Richard goes to when he wants to mark small but significant victories.
For us, we celebrate when, like, Luke gives us a high five. When he started giving us high fives, we're like...
And then there was the moment when Luke responded to his name.
He was five when we could call him, and then he could actually respond. He'd turn and look at you and then actually respond to his own name. Because
Richard says it's not possible to gauge what kind of life Luke will live.
We hope that he can live an independent life. We hope that he has a regular relationship. We hope that he can live on his own. But for me, the big thing is that he's just happy.
These hopes are similar to those Duncan has for his son, Luca.
Luca is self-dependent.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't need someone to take care of him. Can do everything basically by himself. We've discovered his talent, and we are focusing on his talent.
Yeah. Although those are the changes Duncan wants for Luca, Luca has also changed Duncan.
I think I've become a better man.
How?
I've patience. I'm more calm in terms of some situations when I look at it, and I don't react very quickly. I used to be very volatile.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Nowadays I'm more, I think about it. I've become a better husband because of Luca. I've become a better father because of Luca. I'm always trying to encourage fathers. Do this, try this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get that clear. I'm not perfect. I fail. I keep failing and keep trying. And it has made me a better person in terms of it has motivated me. Like, I work hard
mm-hmm.
so that they can have the quality of life that I want them to have.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Comb. It was produced by me, Kim Chaganeza, Mary Goodhart, and Aisha Afra. Rob Wilson did the sound design. Our editor is Pierce Lynch. Our studio manager is Derek Clark. And a special thanks to Christine Mungai for all her help with this episode.